We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com.
It's been an exciting time, actually, around the campus to see many people come to know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Saviour. No greater thing actually happens in anybody's life than that. Even those who are outside the faith in Jesus Christ will be able to perceive that someone committing their life to something must be a fairly big and momentous event. And it is. And for many people, tremendous moment in their life. Sometimes they feel excited about it, sometimes they don't. I did hope that we would finish last Friday on the topic, what is a Christian and how to become one? In our tapes, we've actually already got some of the tapes done up, and there is a tape on what is a Christian and how to become one, which you can buy. I understand the price is $2. I hope that's right. They're confident. $2, which is almost the price of a blank cassette. So you might... My life's work's gone into it, adding to the blank cassette. The price has not gone up. Do come and buy these subsidised tapes. They cost millions, really, but we'll give them to you for $2. On what is a Christian and how to become one in particular. So I thought we'd go back to the topic, but we'd do it differently in this last series by going to the words of Jesus and seeing what he has to say as to what is a Christian and how to become one, which is a little difficult seeing he never uses the word Christian, of course, but what it is to be one of his followers, how and why and what's it all about. And I thought we'd do that by looking at a passage in the Gospel according to Mark, one of the documents of the New Testament. And I also hope that by doing it, I will encourage those of you who are not used to reading the New Testament documents to see how easy they are to understand and how significant are the statements that they are making. I know and I can guess that there are some people here who will want to start saying, yes, but how do you know they're reliable or you know, aren't you just assuming that they are true and so on? And what I want to suggest to you is that while it is necessary for us to investigate their reliability, and I do hope you'll take the opportunity of browsing in the bookstall or asking questions and making comments, etc., so as to investigate their reliability, while that's a worthwhile thing to do, you must do it in the context of reading them at the same time. There are some people who seem to be great experts in investigating something they've got no intention of reading. You've got to do the two things at the same time. What is it that the New Testament is saying? And what are the implications of what it is saying to me here and now? That is worth investigating. It is also worth investigating, where did this New Testament come from? Who wrote it? To whom? Under what circumstances? Are they trustworthy and so on? That also is worth investigating. I haven't got time to go into that today, it's just purely time. I'm happy to do that, and we've done it on previous occasions. There are lots of books that are available to do it, and if it's your real problem, write it down in the comment cards. Put your name and address there and tick that box down the bottom corner about, oh, I want to read more, find out more, etc. And we'll contact you and spend all the time you want going through with you the evidences about the reliability of it. So I've just got to leave that aside purely for time, not for lack of interest, not for lack of importance as a topic. And actually say, well, what is it that these documents are saying? What is it that the person Jesus is recorded to have said about what it is to be a Christian, what it is to be one of his followers? And so I've selected a section from Mark's Gospel, one of the four accounts of the life of Jesus, and a section that's right in the middle of his Gospel. To help you with context, you'll have to check it out later by getting a copy. I'm sorry, the ones that we're giving away free down here are John's Gospel, but it's easy enough to buy a Mark's, so we're giving it this one's the whole New Testament, so you can find Mark's Gospel in that. It's the second of the books in that one, so you can check out the context yourself later. But the context runs like this. Mark really falls into two halves. The first eight chapters deals with the question of who is Jesus? The second half, chapters 9 to 16, deals with the question of why has he come? Great simplification, I don't doubt that for a moment. I mean, I'm summing it up in two headings. Who is Jesus? And he goes about doing all kinds of things that keep on raising the issue of who is he? Who is this man that speaks to the crowds? Who is this man that drives out evil spirits? Who is this man who raises up the sick? Who is this man who says the things he says? Who is he? Is the burning question of the first eight chapters of Mark's Gospel. And then, at the end of chapter 8, he is for the first time identified by a man, by Peter and the apostles and the disciples, the immediate followers of Jesus, finally work out who he is. And that becomes the turning point of the gospel, for from here on in, he starts talking about why he has come. He has come to die, to be crucified, and to rise again on the third day. And why is it he has come to die? What does it mean? And the story takes its change, and so it's not just a random passage I've picked. I've actually picked the very part of the account where the turning point of the life of Jesus takes place, and it's the very point, it's at that point that Jesus says to the crowds what they've got to do to be one of his people. And that, I thought, was the point at issue that we need to raise today if we're going to say what is a Christian and how do you become one, so as to see what Jesus said was a Christian and how you become one. There are, if you're a person who finds listening to lectures easier by having titles, there are three topics that we're going to work on. Who am I? What is a Christian? And why should I become one? I pick on those because who am I is where it starts off. And in fact, the logic of the whole passage runs along who am I, what is a Christian, and why should I become one? I read from the beginning of the passage. Jesus said, "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Christ." And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Out of my sight, Satan," he said. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed with him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." I'm sorry, I think we've left a verse out there. So when you check it up later, make sure that it's not a crucial verse. It just takes out one of the points in the talk. It's the second last verse. Now, that's right, he's left out, isn't it? My memory failing me? Right. Good, eh? So do check up on the accuracy, won't you? Truth is very important. The whole thing starts off on, who do men say that I am? That's the question Jesus poses to them. He's been posing it all along, all the eight chapters, but now he actually is explicit with his disciples. Okay, who do men say that I am? And they give the answers that the ancient world would give. The answers that we know people did give from other sources. Or some say you're John the Baptist, come back from the dead. Poor old Herod, he had John the Baptist beheaded and had a very bad conscience about it. And he thought that John the Baptist had come back from the dead just to spook him. Others said, "You're the Elijah," because in the Old Testament the Jews were told that Elijah would come before the great day. And so they were always looking for Elijah. Well, maybe this Jesus is the Elijah who had been promised. Others say, "You are one of the prophets." Prophets were in the history of Israel. They hadn't been for some centuries, but people were looking for the prophets, especially as Moses had prophesied, that a great prophet was coming. Jesus was certainly acting like the prophets, preaching to the crowds, doing incredible deeds. I mean, he seemed like one of the prophets. There are the judgments of the ancient Jew. I don't think they're the judgments of modern man. If you do a little survey and go out in the street here and go up outside the chemistry building and ask all the people who wander in and out of that building, who do you say that Jesus is? I doubt whether anyone will say Elijah. I don't think anyone will even say John the Baptist. I think most people have got that clear. Some will say he's a prophet. Some will say that. Thank you. Let me just give you that other verse that comes in. Yeah, it's the second last sentence. What can a man give in exchange for his soul? Thank you, that helps me. I need that little later on. You can certainly, you see, you won't have those kinds of answers. What kind of answers do you get today? Oh, he was a great teacher. He was the founder of a religion. He was a first century Jew. He was a legendary character. He was, you know, there's all kinds of answers that people might come out with now. In our survey of 1,000 students, we found that 45% of them said he is God. We were surveying not a Christian university, but at least a Christianised country. But that was the response that came at the, I hate to confess, the University of New South Wales. But I learnt my surveying techniques at the University of Sydney. Now, Jesus then shifts the question, asks a different question. You see it there in the next sentence. He says, but you, what about you? Who do you say that I am? Now, at one level, it looks just the same question. Another level, it's profoundly and completely different, isn't it? See, if I were to say to you, who did the people of Australia vote for at the last federal election? Well, there's no great problem there. Most of us can remember. I think his name's something about some bird of some type. Was it a peacock? No. I think I've got it. It was a hawk, right? That is what it was. No great difficulty, all right? Who did people... But if I said to you, okay, who did you vote for? The answer's very different, isn't it? Some of you say, no, it's not. I voted for Hawke. Fair. No, the answer is very different. The answer now is, none of your business. My vote's a private ballot. I'm keeping it private. I don't have to tell you. I can easily tell you who everybody else voted for. That's public information. But who I voted for, that doesn't tell you anything about public information. That now tells you something about me. Something that I may want to share with you or I may not want to share with you. Especially if I suspect you voted the other way to me. Who do you say that I am is a very different question to who do people say that I am. Jesus turns on the apostles, the disciples, and says, okay, who do you say that I am? And now Peter, always the one quick with the mouth, basically only opens it to change feet, Peter says, you are the Christ. This is the first time someone has recognised Jesus as the Messiah. The word Christ is the Greek word, the Hebrew word's Messiah. Both of them have just been absolutely mutilated by the Australian accent. But Christ, Messiah, the same thing. You're the Messiah, you're the Christ, you're the long-awaited King of Israel who comes to free us from the bondage to the pagans who have ruled over us. The Persians, the Greeks, now the Romans. You've come to conquer them and to set up the new state of Israel, which will rule over all the world for all time. You are the King of Israel. You are the Messiah. And I am glad to be your general. He's hidden underneath, reading between the lines. You are the Messiah. Now that's Peter's answer. But Jesus' question is still different. Jesus' question is, who do you say that he is? There's no point telling me Peter's answer. That's no different than telling me what the other people in the ancient world believed, or any different from telling me what thousands of university students believe. The question is, who do you say is Jesus? Now, there are several options that you have available to you there, don't you? I don't know. There's a good option. Honest and straightforward. And of course, you will take the opportunity of finding out by taking one of our free copies of the original documents, the source documents on the subject, and buying books that can lead you through that material and help you understand it if need be, like this marvellous book we're selling for $4, $3, $4, gone up from last time I was here. Get onto it quickly, you'll never be able to afford it in the years to come. $4, a fresh start to find out who was Jesus. You don't know? All right, no shame in not knowing. There is shame in not knowing and burying your head in the sand, but there's no shame in not knowing. You don't know? Buy. Take for nothing. Get some tapes that we have made. Write a comment, write a question, ask us to meet with you and share with you the information. It's public information, quite available. You don't know? That's one answer. There are other answers that you might want to give. There's a famous analysis of it. It's not original to me by any means, and many of us are sick to death of it, but I can't think of a better one, so here it goes. There's a famous analysis of it saying there are four options, the four L's. Liar, lunatic, legend, or Lord. Say, he's a lunatic, that's who he was. I mean, when people go around saying they're God, they're by and large lunatics. He's a man who goes around saying he's God, he's a lunatic. Or say he's a legend. Something happened back there in the dim, dark past of history, but it's like Prince Arthur, you can never be sure. You know, you have to... Or you say he's a liar. He was a perpetrator of an out-and-out fraud. Or you say he's the Lord. But really, friends, there are only a few options available to you in the assessment of Jesus. And one of the crucial questions I'd put to you as soon as you actually start saying what your assessment is how do you know? Because that's the question you want to put to me too. That is the question of what is the evidence for the reliability of these documents that you put your confidence in. It's a perfectly appropriate question, but remember, friends, if you're going to ask me that question, I'm going to ask you my question. How do you know? Upon what evidence have you based your opinion on who Jesus is? Maybe now I don't know is a more attractive alternative for you. It's all very well to say, oh, well, he's a legend. But I'm going to start saying to you, well, what do you make of the documents? They say, oh, well, something happened and it all got bigger and better later on. And I say, like kind of the resurrection story that he came back from the dead. That's a late bit added on later. And you say, yes, yes, that's right. And I say, well, how do you account for the fact that the very first documents have it? I mean, if it's a legend that got bigger and better as the years rolled on, how come it's at its very biggest and best from the very beginning? You see, what are you going to do with that evidence? And you'll say, well, I thought it was a legend because it sounded like a safe option. Let me move to another one. Okay, I'm happy for you to move to the safe options, but provided you're going to look at the evidence and base them on the evidence and not just on wishful thinking of what I would like to have of Jesus, where I'd like to place him into my categories of thought, into my hip pocket, whereby I can dispense with him. Who do you think Jesus is? In a pregnant pause of now, I think you most likely would find it helpful if you wrote it on the back of your card. Don't know. Liar. I tell you why, because you see, you sit there saying, yeah, any one of those. In other words, I am brainless and not going to use my brains to think today. Can you put it on? Can you put pen on cardboard at the moment and say, I think he's a legend? Can you do that? Can you put your pen on paper and say, I think he is a liar? Can you do that? Have you actually formed your opinion? And remembering, of course, that the very next question is, on what evidence have you formed that opinion? If you haven't formed your opinion, absolutely free. Occupies a space in your bookshelf, makes you look more learned. $4, very easy to read. Even shorter, it's all there. You investigate. We do free studies with anybody at your convenience, at your time. Stop the moral cowardice of saying, oh, well, I'll think about it sometime, somewhere. Tell you why, because you see, if he's the Lord, then this is not an issue to fiddle around with, and obviously, patently obviously, I believe he is the Lord, and many of us here do. He is God who made you and who one day is going to hold you account. You're going to be face to face with him in death. Now, we may be stark raving mad, we may be completely wrong. But I'm saying the claims that are involved are massive in their importance and relevance. And to ignore them on the basis that I haven't looked at the evidence, and I'm not going to look at the evidence because, well, Saturday afternoon I want to watch the All Blacks, to ignore them on that kind of basis is the classic stance of the ostrich in the sand. Who am I? Peter gets the right label, you are the Christ. At least Jesus accepts that as the right label. The trouble with Peter is, although he's got the right label, he's got the wrong product. Very easy to do that. You say, oh, Jesus, he's Christ. 45%, New South Wales University, 1,000 students, he is God. You only have to ask the next question, well, what part does he play in your life? And you'll get the answer, nothing. What kind of God is it that plays no part in your life? You see, you've got the right label, but you haven't got the right product. You are the Christ, you're the King of Israel, you're the one who's coming to conquer the world for Israel and set up the kingdom from Jerusalem that will rule over everywhere forever. You are, that's what you are. And Jesus says, yes, I am come here to be executed publicly, to be handed over by the people of Israel to the pagans, that I'll be crucified by them and rise again on the third day. Peter's mind's blown. That cannot be. No. That's not the way to come to kingly power, getting executed. You know, we are looking forward to your coronation, not your execution. No, it cannot be that way. I don't think Prince Charles, if he ever gets crowned, will actually think that he's going to be crowned by being crucified in Westminster Abbey. Most people who think they're going to come to be king think of more glamorous fashions of coming to their power than by execution. That's what Jesus is saying. I'm going to be killed. Peter says no. He's got the right product, the right label. Jesus is Christ, he's the king, but he doesn't understand anything about the kingdom of Jesus. And Jesus says, Peter, get behind me, you're Satan. You're actually in the enemy camp at the moment. You're not in the friends at this moment. The kind of kingdom I come is not against the Romans. The kind of kingly power I bring is not the free, nationalistic, chauvinistic interests of Israel. I have come to lay down my life for mankind and to bring in the judgment of the world by my resurrection. I have come fighting a different battle altogether. A supernatural spiritual battle about the powers and principalities that rule this world in evil. I haven't come just as a political revolutionary, a militaristic king. I have come to suffer and to die. And in my suffering and in my death, to bring in the reign of God that will last forever. And to the judgment of God that is found in the resurrection at the last day. I have come to die and rise again. What then is a Christian? Jesus, having rebuked Peter like that, calls upon the crowds to follow him. But having now spelt out what kind of Messiah he is, he spells out what it is to be a messianic man. What kind of Christ he is, what kind of Christian he's talking about, in the same terms. You see it there in the paragraph where it says, then he called the crowd to him. It's the last paragraph, isn't it? The long one there. Then he called to the crowd, and now we see what it is to be a Christian. What is a Christian? He called the crowd to him, and he said to his disciples, and he said, if anyone would come after me. This is not addressed to a select group. This is not Jesus teaching to his inner disciples, his 12 or his three disciples. That's the crowd, and it's anyone. Whoever wants to follow me. If you want to be a follower of Jesus, then this is what you must do. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. There are the three things he must do, and those three things are explained as one thing in the next sentence. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake, for me and for the gospel, will save it. To deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me will be the same as losing your life for me. See, what do they mean? It's a funny phrase to say, you must deny yourself, isn't it? You actually want to say, deny myself what? You want something. I mean, I know what it is to deny myself a milkshake. I don't know experientially. I've never denied myself a milkshake, but I know theoretically what it would mean to deny myself a milkshake. It is to say, no milkshake today, you fat slob. Speaking to myself. I know what that means. I know what it means to deny an accusation levelled against me.
I'm not a fat slob. Very thin, tight, taut muscle and all that. See? I know how to say no, that's not true. Deny always carries with it the idea of saying no. But now I've got to say no to myself. Now that is a very strange thing to say no to. I've never said no to myself in my life. I always say yes to me. No to everybody else, but yes to me. What does it mean to say no to myself? You see, here is the exact reversal of what sin is all about. Sin is saying yes to self. Sin is doing it your own way. Sin is being Frank Sinatra. The epitome of sin. Because whatever else he's done in life, he's done it my way. And all kind of people have followed that quintessential sinner. They've even painted houses my way. The essence of what sin is rebellion against God, is the rejection of God and the desire to lead life my way, to set myself up as God. And Jesus says the fundamental first step you've got to do is to say no to self. Self-government is over. That immediately turns all kinds of people off because they want to live life their own way. That's the whole point at issue. Second thing, you must take up your cross. Jesus says, I am to be crucified, and if you're going to be my follower, you've got to take up your cross too. The convicted criminal used to carry his cross out to the point of execution. Actually, he carried the crossbar, not the whole cross thing. He carried the crossbar out to the place of execution. The uprights were already there. And the carrying of the cross was a sign that you were a condemned man. And on the way, the crowds used to jostle and cheer and throw things at you, and like in the medieval stocks. And it was said that there were some men who actually were pleased to arrive at the place of execution because the crowds had treated them so badly en route. Jesus says, you must declare yourself as a dead person. You're no longer a person who matters. You are now living, yes, but you're just living on the way to your execution. You are a condemned person. So fundamentally have you said no to self that you take up the cross. Now Christians at this point sound like a masochist society. They do, don't they? It's a dreadful sounding society to be in. Who wants to be a masochist? The third thing Jesus says is that you must follow me. Follow me in my death, yes, but follow me. You no longer walk your way doing your thing. You and your way is now over and dead. You now walk my way doing my thing. And that's why it's not a massacre society, because Jesus is the lover of life and generosity and all good things, and you follow him and he provides for you a life that is rich and free and full and abundant and happy and marvellous. And I won't go on about it. The only way you'll ever believe me is by being a Christian, but having been a Christian for nearly 25 years, it is marvellous. Because Jesus, the one I follow, loves me so much that he gives me all the good things of life that I could ever want, and even more than I've ever thought of asking for. It's not a massacre society, but the first step of it was to say no to me running my own life. No longer walking my way, that's dead and buried. Now I turn and follow and walk his way. In other words, those three things are summed up in the next verse, if you look at it, the next sentence. Sorry about verse, it's a religious word. They're usually numbered with little numbers. Most of you know about it, some of you don't. The next sentence. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will save it. If you say to me, okay, Philip, I hear what you've got to do, but I don't want to give up my life. I want to run things my own way. I'm going to hang on to it. I'm going to save it. Well, Jesus says, if you save your life in the end, you'll lose it. But if you lose your life for me now, if you say, okay, drop dead, Philip, I'm going to live for Jesus, then in the end you save it. What is a Christian? A Christian is a person who's dead and buried and brought to new life. There's all kinds of pictures used of it. The Bible talks about being born again. And you can understand why, don't you? Because we've actually said no to myself. No to my self-government, my self-rule, my living my own life, my own way to please me. No to self-centeredness, which of course you all know is totally antisocial and unhelpful. Indeed, it's not even satisfying to yourself in the long run, but it's something that we think will make us happy somehow, that we think will be right. It's a terrible, terrible idea, but we all live it. And so what Jesus is saying, stop being so stupid as living for yourself, and now live for the one who made you and who's about to die for you that you can be saved. What is a Christian? One who has said no to self and yes to Jesus. By no longer living his own life, her own life, but now living Jesus' life. That's the radical change that Jesus calls upon us to make. That is the nature of a Christian. Now, why should I become one? The third subject to touch on today. Why should I become one? Because Jesus goes on, and you can already start to feel the argument in terms of, well, if you save your life now, you're going to lose it, whereas if you lose your life now, you're going to save it. That's part of the argument as to why. And he goes on further to argue. Now, there's lots of reasons as to why you should become one. For example, I believe it's a good reason to become one is because it's true. It's a fairly obvious reason to believe in, but that's the I think it's the truth. Seems to me silly to believe in something, even something that works, if it's a lie. But I think it's true. Now you say, well, I don't know if it's true or not. Well, we've got all kinds of books here to advertise. Do you get the message? I believe it is true enough for you to investigate, and I'm willing to give you books. Subsidise books, give you time, spend to show it to you. It is so patently true. You investigate. But I believe it's... I'll tell you another reason. It's because it's consistent with what I have written on the back of my card about who I think Jesus is. You didn't write it on the back of your card, did you? But in your heart of hearts, you knew that it was the answer was the Lord. You, like many others, say, oh, yeah, well, I know he's God. Well, if I know he's God, then I should treat him as God. And living my own life for myself is not treating Jesus as God. That is absolutely inconsistent with what I know. And so, not only is it true, but it's a matter of consistency to do that which I know to be true. They're not the reasons Jesus gave. I just thought I'd throw them in en route. The reasons Jesus gave are in the last few sentences. There are three, now that I've got a modified version of the sheet in front of you. The first is the one of losing your life and saving it. I may say the three are all very similar. Losing your life and saving it. If you hang on to your life now, you in the long run will lose it. Whereas if you lose your life now, in the long run you'll save it. That's the reason. Because in the end you know you're going to die. What's going to happen then? If you know Jesus is the Lord, you know that he is the Lord of life and death. And you know that face to face with him then, you will be his person. Whereas if you hung on to your own life all this time, then when you're face to face with him, you're not his person. Fancy facing the judge that way. The second argument, very similar. What shall it profit? What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? There's the second argument. What have you got if you've got everything? You've gathered all that there is. You see, you've saved your life. I'm going to live my life my way for me. And so I go out and get my university degree, and I go and get a good job, and I gather in money, and I marry a beautiful husband or a beautiful wife, and we have wonderful children, and we get the cars, and we get the houses, and we get the overseas trip, and we've got all the things that are going that you can get. What happens if I gain everything there is to gain if I lose my soul? And the third argument, the one that's left out, I'll read to you. It's just the reverse of the same thing again. What can a man give in exchange for his soul? Friends, many of people I've spoken to over the years have actually made the choice in this area. My brother had a friend we went through school with. He believed Jesus was the Lord. He knew Jesus had died and risen again. He didn't doubt that, like many, many Australians believe it, like many here do. But he had a non-Christian girlfriend who was very, very aggro in terms of religion and Christianity. She didn't want to have a bar of anything to do with Christianity. And when the issue came down and we talked to our friend about it, he said, look, I cannot be a Christian and have her. She won't have me if I'm a Christian. And I will not live without her. So I will not become a Christian. Now what has that man done, you see? He has gained a girlfriend at the price of his own soul. I'd suggest even his own integrity. The dreadful part of it, of course, was that 1 month later she dropped him for another fellow. What he actually gained wasn't worth having, was it? 1 month more of a bad relationship. Or again, I spoke to a man, he was a telegraphic linesman, and we spoke in the wee small hours of the morning, I remember, and he knew it was true. His mother was a Christian, actually, and he always knew it was true. And he cried. Men don't often cry in Australia. I do, but men don't. Mind you, I don't eat quiche. Except in front of truck drivers. He cried like a baby. Wanted to become a Christian. But he said, I couldn't face the fellas on Thursday night because Thursday night we always get paid and go down the pub and get drunk. And he said, I wouldn't be able to walk away from that. Incredible thing, really. When I say it myself now, I cannot believe that someone would think like that. I know I was there, I heard him say it, I knew the fact. He wouldn't become a Christian because he was afraid of the pressure of the pub. Don't get me wrong, I don't think drinking alcohol is necessarily wrong. I'm talking about getting drunk. He wasn't just going down and drinking, he was going down to get drunk. And he could see that was inconsistent with being a Christian. But he couldn't see that you could live without it. A stupid argument. What you sell your soul for? What is it that's worthwhile? Your degree? Your marriage? Yesterday afternoon I walked over to a football game at this conference I was at with a bloke, 24. Come back to university, he dropped out. He's divorced. His wife walked out on him after 12 months of marriage. There he is, 24, having to put his life all back together again. Fancy giving your life for a marriage partner. Very risky in today's world, isn't it? But it's not just that you've got to put your life back together again. How do you actually face death? I was interrupted in watching the football game. I was called out because one of the fellows at the conference was needed urgently on the telephone. So I had to go into the crowd and find him and take him over to the telephone and got a message from home. Mother had just died. Yesterday afternoon, I spent the afternoon walking him back, packing him up so as he could travel home. Yesterday, I spent 2.5 hours with a young man, a first-year student, whose mother in her mid-40s had died. Yeah, I cry a lot. I cried with him, and I prayed with him. Because, you see, death is also remote, isn't it, until it's there. And then what's all your life? It's interesting what you talk about in 2 hours while you're waiting for your lift to come when your mother's just died. Told me about childhood memories, told me about going fishing, told me about walking with his mum and doing this, and almost every story came back to mum. Almost every story was about what life was and how meaningful and wonderful and how... And nearly every story ended with that terrible empty lump in the throat, which you said, but it's all gone. It's just not there anymore. It doesn't exist. What does it profit you when you've gained everything and you lose life? Tolstoy told a brilliant story in his short stories. I've never been able to get through his long novels, but there's a great little story about a man who went to do a land deal in Russia, took all his family savings, went to the other end of Russia, and the land deal was that you could walk around the land that you wanted, and as much land as you took in that circle was the amount of land you got for a set price. And so he tries to work out. So it's a very cunning, clever thing. As their real estate agents would have thought this one up, because the greedier you are, the less chance you've got of actually encircling it, and so the less chance of ever doing it. Whereas if you're not very greedy, you don't get much land. So he calculates carefully how much land he can take in. And he tries to work it out in terms of how much land he needs. And Tolstoy tells it with that pathetic grasp of the sadness of life as this man, heavy, middle-aged man, runs all day through the swamps and through the valleys and over around hills to try and get as much land for his family as he can for the set price. And how, as he comes back to the hill from which he, the top of which he started, the sun starts to glow down. And as he reaches the bottom of that hill, the sun overtakes him. And the end of time has come. And he is just 400 yards from encircling the land. He has got nothing. And he falls down, collapsed on the ground, exhausted. And then he hears this wicked cry of all the people up on the top of the hill who started him off shouting and jeering, and he thinks that's cruelest of all. But then as he looks up at them in hatred, he sees that they're actually still in the sunlight, because they can still see the sun from there. And the line of the sun is actually just slowly edging up the hill. And so with the last kind of supernatural effort that he can muster, he runs up the hill, charging up to get ahead of the last rays of the sun, so as to be able to arrive there and finish it off. And right at the last minute, he overtakes the sun and he sees the last rays of the sun set, and he has completed his task. And then, with this enormous pathos that comes out of the Russian, Tolstoy describes how he collapses and dies. The heading of the story, the title of the story, which if you get it out of the library you'll find is told much better than I've just rattled it through then. The title of the story is, How Much Land Does a Man Need? And Tolstoy's last sentence gives you the answer. 6 feet by 2. That is all you're going to occupy. That is all you need. What have you gained if you have gained everything and lost your soul? I've said enough about how to investigate today. I want to talk to those people who want to save their souls. The rest of you will just bear with me. How do you save your soul? I've told you already, you turn from self to Jesus. How do you do that? Well, there should be a prayer printed here on the back of the sheet. It's a prayer which actually is based on the very ideas of Jesus. And I want you to pray this prayer with me this day, if you wish to save your soul, because you'll be giving it to Jesus. You see, it says, Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be called a child. You see that there in the first sentence of it? It's down the bottom of the page there. It describes where you are, living for yourself. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you, and I need forgiveness. It's describing you as you are, without God. It then thanks God for sending his Son to die for me that I may be forgiven, and rising again that I might have new life. And then the last sentence, please forgive me and change me that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. Many of you have been here day after day and you've been listening. I know I can actually see and recognise faces after a while in the crowd. The last time we're going to be doing this time in this session, to pray this prayer and to give you the opportunity of praying it along with me, to ask Jesus to take over my life, to lose my life for his sake, that I may save it. Are you ready to make that commitment to God? Not to me, to God. If so, will you join me in praying this? Pray it in the quietness of your own mind to God as I pray the words out loud. And in a few moments I'll get you to indicate that you've done that by writing it on the card so that we can talk with you further. Let's pray. Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be called a child of God. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you. I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your Son to die for me that I may be forgiven. Thank you that you raised Jesus to give me new life. And now please forgive me. Please change me. that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.